At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question and answer session of today's call. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this point. Now, I will turn the meeting over to your host, Lauren Gashish. You may begin.
Thank you. Good morning, and thank you for joining us to hear NOAA's 2020 Winter Outlook for the United States. My name is Lauren Gashish from NOAA Communications. If you have questions following the briefing today, you can reach me via email at lauren.gashish@noaa.gov, which is available on the top of today's media advisory, and by phone at 202-740-8314. NOAA produces seasonal temperature and precipitation outlooks and the U.S. drought outlook to help communities prepare for what is likely to come in the next few months and minimize weather impacts on lives and livelihoods. Today's discussion will begin with brief remarks, then we'll take questions from reporters. A recording of this briefing will be made available online at noaa.gov. At the bottom of our press release, about 90 minutes after our call ends today. Delivering the U.S. Winter Outlook is Mike Halpert, Deputy Director of NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, located in College Park, Maryland. Mike is on the team that develops the seasonal forecasts and the El Nino Southern Oscillation Diagnostic Discussion. Here's Mike Halpert.
Thank you, Lauren. The National Weather Service plays a critical role in helping the nation to prepare for extreme weather and climate events. Providing impact-based decision support services improves America's ability to prepare for, respond to, and recover from extreme events. By empowering the public to make fast, smart, and life-saving decisions, we are able to build a more weather-ready and climate-smart nation. The Winter Outlook is produced in order to give American communities the best possible scientific prediction of how we think the weather will develop across the nation. The Climate Prediction Center issues these seasonal forecasts so users can account for risks and opportunities when making climate-sensitive decisions. This outlook supports everyone, from local and state governments that must plan for public needs this winter, to large and small businesses as they determine how the winter could impact transportation, market demand for their goods and services, and prices. The Winter Outlook is probabilistic in nature, meaning that the maps show those areas that are most likely to be warmer or colder than normal and wetter or drier. However, the nature of a probabilistic forecast means that other outcomes are always possible, just less likely. And in fact, for our probabilities to be reliable, the less likely outcomes must occur from time to time. La Nina developed during August and is expected to persist at least through the winter. Therefore, it shouldn't be a surprise that both the temperature and precipitation outlooks are consistent with typical La Nina impacts, which includes a characteristic warmer, drier south and cooler, wetter north. Heading into winter, the big story this year is likely to be drought. An almost non-existent monsoon season resulted in extreme to exceptional drought in parts of the Southwest, extending from West Texas to Colorado and Utah, with significant drought also prevailing westward through Nevada, Northern California, and the Pacific Northwest. Drought is also present in parts of the Northeast, Ohio Valley, Hawaii, and Alaska. I will add this is the most widespread drought that we have seen in the continental U.S. since September 2013. And the winter forecast doesn't bode well for many of the areas around the nation currently experiencing drought, with the exception of the Pacific Northwest, the Northwest, and Hawaii and Alaska. Specifically, the winter 2020 precipitation forecast favors wetter than average conditions across most of the northern United States, extending from the Pacific Northwest, eastward to the eastern Great Lakes and the Ohio Valley, in Hawaii, and also in northern Alaska. Drier than normal conditions across the entire southern U.S. and southern Alaska are also favored. The temperature outlook favors warmer than normal conditions across the southern two-thirds of the continental U.S., along the entire east coast, in Hawaii, and in western and northern Alaska. Below average temperatures along the northern tier of the country from Minnesota to the Pacific Northwest and in southeastern Alaska are also most likely. The rest of the country falls into the equal chances category, which means they have an equal chance for above, near, or below normal temperatures and or precipitation, because there was just not a strong enough climate signal in these areas to shift the odds. With regards to drought conditions during the months ahead, drought is expected to persist in much of the western half of the nation, in the Ohio Valley, and in parts of the Northeast. Drought is likely to develop in central and southern California, the central and southern plains, and in southern Georgia and northern Florida. And finally, drought conditions are expected to improve in the northern Rockies, the Pacific Northwest, New England, Alaska, and Hawaii. And with that, let me turn it back to Lauren.
Thanks, Mike. Before we move on to the Q&A, I want to introduce David Miskus. He leads the Climate Prediction Center's Drought Outlook team and contributes to the weekly Drought Monitor. David will take drought-related questions, while Mike Halpert will focus on questions about the seasonal temperature and precipitation outlooks. Also joining us on the call is Ira Sanchez Lugo, a climatologist from NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information. Operator, if you would please, we can begin the Q&A.
Thank you, Lauren. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. Please unmute your phone and record your name and affiliation clearly when prompted. Your name is required to introduce your question. To cancel your request, press star 2. And speakers, one moment for the first question. All right, our first question comes from Seth Bornstein with the Associated Press. Seth, your line is open.
Thank you. Actually, I have two questions. First for Mike, in terms of this has been, in the Arctic, especially places like Siberia, it's been record warm, and a lot of that heat has gone into the ocean in the polar region there. Have you factored in, do you expect any of the heat that's trapped in the ocean that might be released back to the atmosphere, any of that to affect sort of the polar vortex? Are we likely to see some more wandering and weaker polar vortex this season or not? And then the second question, maybe more for David, is if it's right now about 45% of the CONUS is drought struck, about what percent are we looking at by the end, by deep winter here? Thank you.
All right, Seth, this is Mike. I'll take the first part of the question. Certainly what goes on over the Arctic and in the extratropical oceans, can influence the weather. It's oftentimes, though, in an unpredictable fashion. The way we would typically leverage that would be from our climate model forecasts. And the reality is that there's really no indication that we'll see, kind of a weak polar vortex and very cold weather. Obviously, at this point, we think the most likely areas to be cold are in the northern plains and the Pacific Northwest, and that's really linked to the ongoing La Nina.
Hey, Seth, this is Dave Miskus here. For your second question, the good news is I guess while we look for possible development of drought and expansion across the southern tier of states and in the southwest, the northern tier up in the Pacific Northwest, the northern Rockies, and maybe the northern plains, and also New England will probably show some improvement in the next several months. So while you get an increase in drought in the south, you get a decrease of drought in the north. So maybe they'll balance each other out and we'll be pretty much similar to where we are now in a couple of months from now.
All right, thank you.
Our next question comes from Brian Sullivan with Bloomberg News. Brian, your line is open.
Thank you. excuse me. California has been having a great deal of difficulty from the heat and the dry conditions out there. Could you dig in a little bit and just, is there any kind of relief that California can expect this year, or is the La Nina going to lock everything down so they're not going to get anything?
You know, again, this is Mike. Obviously we favor dry and warm for California, and especially Central and Southern California. But that certainly doesn't mean, you know, that the entire 3 months, and of course we're actually looking, you know, a month ahead. This is only October, so we still have a little bit of a lead up before we get to that point. You know, it's hard to really comment on the typical variability throughout the season. That's something that while we would love to be able to share and provide information on, the reality is that the science just doesn't allow for that. I don't believe there's all that much relief in our shorter range outlooks at this point, but it certainly doesn't preclude that from occurring.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Bruce, this is Dave Miskus here. And for the drought outlook, we were thinking there's some chance of maybe some improvement up in the northern portion of California where more of their larger reservoirs are at. So if the La Nina does come true and there's some enhanced precipitation during the winter, hopefully northern California can get a little bit of a break as far as the drought goes and fill up some of those reservoirs.
I will add, not the outlook. This is Mike again. That we're talking about the winter outlook. The current forecast for November that was also issued this morning. Again, favors above average temperatures over the whole state and a slight tilt towards dry in the southern part. So we're not highlighting any real possibility. Not that it can occur, but we're not highlighting. We're not favoring above average precipitation on even our shorter time scales right now.
Okay.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Joan Grala. Joan, your line is open.
Good morning. Well, our readers are terribly interested in the outlook for eating out. But my question is more, I see Paris this spring said no restaurants. We're not going to have you plunking heaters on the sidewalk because we don't like climate change. Is there any way for you folks to assess the impact of radiant or other heating used by restaurants outside this winter in urban areas, perchance?
I'm not sure if that's one that might be for you or if that's something that perhaps would be for our OAR.
She cut out a little bit. I didn't quite understand the question. Can she repeat it again?
Oh, yes, sorry. Okay, so radiant heating, outdoor dining, is that going to wreck our climate, raising temperatures as Paris fears? Because they're not allowing it for their restaurants. But New York City, for example, is.
I don't see how that can impact in terms of climate change at the moment. Outdoor eating, is that what you're asking?
I'm asking about if you put out those big radiant heaters so that people can eat outside.
Okay. Sorry about that.
No, not at all.
No, we do not have any information on that right now in terms of projections or anything. No.
Is it possible that it's something you folks would research?
We don't. Here at NCI, the data that we get is temperature. So I don't think that would have a huge impact. Is that mostly for winter now that it's getting warmer? So no, I don't have any information for you on that right now.
And has anybody, do you happen to know, and I promise this is the last question on this subject, done any studies on the impact, because Los Angeles uses this pretty widely for their terrace restaurants? Nobody's studied that you know of?
Joan, this is Lauren. I think these questions would be best for our colleagues at OAR, the research branch of NOAA, that would have done those kinds
okay.
of tests if they're possible.
All right, that's fine. Thank you.
So let's follow up, if you don't mind, after today's call. I'll be happy to assist you.
Thank you.
Of course.
Thank you, everyone.
Our next question comes from Dan Wanshura with Interlochen Public Radio. Dan, your line is open.
Thanks for taking my question. Yeah, I'm curious to hear your guys' outlook for the Great Lakes region. I'm from a radio station in northern Michigan, and the water levels on the Great Lakes have been really high this year. past couple of years, and I'm wondering how the outlook for the winter might play into that. Is it a positive outlook in terms of high water levels, or does it look like we're going to be in for more trouble? And I'm sorry, I joined a little late. If whoever answers, can you just give me your name and title, please?
Sure. This is Mike Halpert. I'm the Deputy Director with NOAA's Climate Prediction Center. The outlook does favor above average precipitation over all of the lakes. There's not a strong signal temperature-wise for that area. But if there's enough precipitation falls, with the lakes already at high levels, that certainly could exacerbate things.
And can you explain, I know the winter is an important time for evaporation because the air temperature is colder than the water temperature. How does it look in terms of evaporation, or will the lakes freeze over primarily, and will that hinder evaporation?
Well, obviously, if the lakes do freeze over, sure, that will impact evaporation. We don't issue those types of outlooks, as to a evaporation outlooks or lakes freezing. That'll be dependent on whether we see, in particular, some early cold weather. At this point, there's while we expect or we favor colder than average conditions to the west of the lakes, mainly from western Minnesota westward. Michigan and the Great Lakes areas are kind of in between where we're able to say much. So it's kind of a toss up at this point as to even whether we'll see a cold or a warmer winter there.
Thank you.
Operator, if we can go to our next question.
Sure. Our next question comes from Kim Miller from Palm Beach Post. Kim, your line is open.
Hi, thank you so much. In the past, La Nina has had pretty strong ties to drought in South Florida, but I see that that's not predicted this year. Can you talk a little bit about why that is the case?
Yeah, this is Dave Miskus here. The Southeast has been very wet here the last 6 to 12 months, a lot of it due to tropical systems or stalled cold fronts that came across and has just soaked that area. So there's a lot of short and long-term surpluses across the Southeast, including Florida. However, there's a few pockets going out to 3 to 6 months where they're near normal or slightly below normal. So we highlighted on the seasonal drought outlook that area in northern Florida and southern Georgia, because we're expecting very dry conditions with the La Nina through the winter. And we're thinking those areas are probably would be the first ones to get around D1 by the end of January or February. Otherwise, we think the surpluses will hold on long enough to prevent any kind of D1 or drier by the end of January or February.
And when you say surpluses, you mean like groundwater levels or reservoirs?
I think they're the ground levels are pretty good. This is mainly just a meteorological drought, building up some deficits and maybe some topsoil moisture deficits.
Okay.
Because you do get a colder, lower temperatures during the winter, so there's less evapotranspiration. And so that's the season in the winter it is where you get less of the evaporation from the drought. So we're thinking that'll hold on, and there will be no drought there until maybe later in Florida and Georgia, later in the January-February period, if the La Nina holds true and the dryness occurs.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And Kim, this is Mike. Just one thing to be aware of, certainly, is that the drought outlook product actually covers the period only through January, while the winter outlook does cover another month through February.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, so possibly the next one to winter that goes from December, January, February might show a little more development if things progress as we think they might.
Okay.
Thank you, Kim. Our next question comes from Henry Fountain, New York Times. Your line is open.
Thanks. Two questions, actually. One is talking a little about the La Nina, is it moderate or weak, and what kind of difference one or the other might make? And also, is there any idea of the likelihood of this being the hottest year ever or top five or anything like that?
This is Mike. I didn't hear your questions great. I think the first question had to do with the potential strength of this La Nina, which is still developing. It's still a little uncertain as to how strong it will become. I will say the stronger it becomes, the more likely the impacts that we anticipate are to occur. Generally what we see based on the historical record is that weaker events or lead to kind of more variability throughout the winter. The stronger events, oftentimes we see a pattern really lock in and take hold. I didn't catch your second question, Henry. Could you repeat that?
Sure. Yeah. It was just the outlook for 2020 being hottest year ever, top five, whatever.
You're looking at the global temperature for 2020?
Yeah.
I can respond to that. This is Iris Sanchez-Lugo. Hello. So right now we are expecting, through data through September, there is about a 65% chance of the global temperature to rank as the warmest on record, with about a 35% chance of it being second warmest. So it is very likely to end among the 2 to 3 warmest years on records, and it's a very tight race right now.
Does La Nina have an impact on that? I assume it would.
Yes, we typically see that the La Nina tends to help cool a little bit the global temperatures compared to neighboring years where an El Nino was present in the tropical Pacific Ocean. Our statistics, the statistics that I gave you, does not take into account El Nino and La Nina at the moment. We typically see that when it comes to global temperatures, there tends to be a lag in that response, about of 2 to 3 months. So we'll have to see, and we'll have to wait and see what happens. But for right now, it is a very tight race.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Nancy Gerner with Omaha World Herald. Your line is open.
Thank you for taking this our call. Hey, my question actually goes to spring flooding since we've had 2011 and 2019. When I look at a forecast for above average snowpack in the northern plains, that's what comes to my mind. So a couple parts to this question. One is, do you have the capacity to, and I think you've partly answered it already, the capacity to know how intense snowpack could come, how much it could tilt toward the extreme? And so that's part of it, your ability to assess the potential for extreme snowpack based on La Nina. And does La Nina extend into the spring when we get those spring rains on top of snowpack, or does it tend to not be a factor in spring rains in the upper plains? And then do you happen to know whether a La Nina winter was in place preceding the 2011 flooding and the 2019 flooding? So those are my questions. I'd be happy to repeat them. Thank you for your time.
So I can take that. This is Mike. There was a La Nina, pretty healthy one in the 2010-2011 season. So certainly that was a stronger event. Actually, the flooding in 2019 came after an El Nino. So again, this kind of shows you the variability around these things. It doesn't mean, oh, we've got, you know, La Nina, this is what's going to happen. We do in the northern plains favor both below average temperatures and above average precipitation, which, you know, could certainly lead to above average snowpack. Of course, the reality is that snowfall is really more a weather type phenomenon, depending on storm track as much as anything. We've looked into seasonal snowfall forecasts. It's still something that we're trying to develop, since we know there would be a lot of interest in it, but we don't issue that at this point. So can't really comment on expectations for snow in that area. Was there another part of that question that I'm forgetting, Nancy?
Yeah, does La Nina have an influence on spring rains? Because spring rains are a huge factor in the 2011 flooding.
Well, the current spring outlooks really in the northern plains don't have much of anything. If we're looking over Nebraska, there actually is a bit of a tilt towards drier than average conditions. That's kind of a longer lead outlook. As we're talking about the winter outlook right now, we do issue outlooks that go out, seasonal outlooks that go out a year into the future. So at least at this point, you know, we are tilting towards drier than average conditions by the time we get into the spring and at least into the central plains.
Yeah, one last stab at that question. When we have a La Nina winter, does its influence on precipitation linger past the winter months? That's kind of what I'm trying to ask.
Yeah, and actually the forecast we're discussing is certainly related to La Nina. Again, the dry signal that we see across the South for reasons that I honestly can't explain. We oftentimes see that signal kind of extend northward in the middle of the country. So whereas maybe in the winter it's a wetter signal, as we go further into the year, we kind of almost flip it in some areas to a drier signal.
Thank you. I appreciate your help.
Our next question comes from Jarrett Lansford with KTIV-TV. Your line is open.
All right, thank you. I have a couple questions here. KTIV is in Sioux City, Iowa, so they're going to be hyper-focused on the southeast South Dakota, northeast Nebraska, and western Iowa areas. First of all, how does a La Nina typically impact those areas? Second of all, we've been locked in a severe to extreme drought through the summer and fall. Is there any help on the way for that? And also, how might the drought that's in place impact the winter versus the La Nina setup?
So this is Mike. You know, that area is typically, you know, what we see with La Nina is the jet stream oftentimes becomes a little wavier and shifts further to the north. Of course, every event is different. The Iowa Wisconsin area oftentimes falls kind of in between or becomes very uncertain as to whether they become drier as the drier signal and the jet stream shifts further north, or becomes wetter as it doesn't shift quite as far. So the forecast for Iowa are actually that equal chance category, so it's just as likely to be wet or dry, warm or cold in that part of the country. As far as the impact of the current drought on the winter outlook, you know, soil moisture typically plays a stronger role in influencing climate during the warm season, not during the cold season. So, you know, my expectations would be that the La Nina, depending on how we see the jet stream set up this winter, will play a much larger role than an ongoing drought there.
Hey, Jared, this is Dave Miskus here, too. Add to Mike's comments, plus you get into the wintertime where the soils might freeze, so any precipitation that does fall may kind of just stay on the surface and not really get into the subsoil moisture. So we'd have to wait till the spring to see what happens to see any kind of soil moisture recharge. So it's not looking too good for removing that drought in especially western Iowa, where it's been lingering for the last 6 to 9 months here. We'll have to wait and see what the spring brings.
Okay, thank you very much.
Our next question comes from Dave Olson from the forum. Your line is open.
Thank you, and good morning, everyone. Our readers are focused on eastern North Dakota and western Minnesota, and from your outlook, it sounds like we're going to be wetter than average and colder than average this winter. I'm wondering if you know the magnitude of those outlooks. Are we going to be much wetter and much colder? And as with the question from Omaha, spring flooding is always a major concern here. Do your numbers tell you anything about what might be happening here this spring?
So this is Mike. You know, the reality is what our forecasts mean is when we favor above or below, it's basically a tercile type forecast. So it's in the upper tercile, and for temperature, that's really only about a degree or two above or below normal. So favoring below normal doesn't say that it's going to be, you know, the coldest winter on record or anything like that. It certainly is possible, but we're just not able to really be any more specific than that. You know, again, spring flooding will depend on the character of the winter and obviously how much snow falls. You know, a colder, wetter winter, though, would likely favor more snowfall than usual as well, and and possibly lead to flooding concerns as we get to the spring. I will say that NOAA issues a spring flood outlook in March, and so certainly, as we see what happens this winter, that will certainly inform what we say about the spring flood outlook come next March.
Thank you much.
Next question is from Chris Perkins from South Florida Sun Sentinel. Your line is open.
I appreciate you all doing this. I got a couple of quick questions. I believe that they would be for Mike, but anyone is free to answer. I wanted to drill down on South Florida and Broward County, Palm Beach County, and Miami-Dade County. La Nina should bring us a warmer, drier winter, as I understand it. Number one, are we talking about any kind of records there as far as warmth and dryness? And number two, does the La Nina affect the king tides down here?
The first question, right when you were asking specifically what you wanted, I didn't catch it. I'm sorry. Could you repeat that?
Yeah. Is the La Nina winter going to bring any records as far as warmth or dryness down here to South
records.
Florida?
We're not able to forecast records. I'll say that Florida probably has, the best La Nina signal over the U.S. So we're, the probabilities for both above for temperature and below for precipitation are pretty elevated in that area. But it's, records are kind of a unique factor, and a lot goes into that, so really can't give you much guidance on that. Now, as far as tides, that's something that I have actually no experience with, so I will have to pass on that one as well. I'm not sure if anybody else on the phone can comment. I don't know that they can, but I'll leave it to them if they have anything to add. Hearing nothing, I guess no one has anything to add.
All right, thank you.
Next question is from Alan Offey with Cronkite News. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. So I do have a couple questions. I'm not sure who I'll direct this to. But in Arizona, we've seen our, on record, the driest monsoon season this year. I'm just wondering what could have caused this almost non-existent monsoon, and if this is a pattern that you can kind of foresee, how do rising temperatures correlate with such a dry monsoon, or how does rising temperatures correlate with very little rainfall?
This is Dave here. I just don't know if I have a cause for why it was so dry, record dry here, but it's interesting that while the Southwest was extremely dry and warm, which the warmth makes sense because you don't have the moisture, humidity in the air and the rainfall to cool down the temperatures. So I understand the temperatures rising high and record high when there's basically no rain during one of the rainiest times of the year for that area. But then, of course, the Southeast had all the record wetness and systems here. So I don't know why the Pacific area, the monsoon in northern Mexico, I'm not sure how that turned out. Probably didn't fare very well either. Didn't pump that moisture up into the Southwest. Maybe Mike can answer maybe why that didn't occur. Mike?
Thanks, Dave. So the why of those kind of things are really tricky and take a fair amount of study and research. I'm not aware, given that, it's fairly recent that the monsoon failed there, that work has been done yet. So I can't give you a good reason. I will say that, natural climate variability, there's the climate can really react in all kinds of different ways. I'm not aware of links between, climate change or global warming of any sort and that particular monsoon. In general, we talk about the monsoon in the Southwest U.S. It really is it's an important part of the water cycle in that part of the area, but it in general is not a particularly wet, as when you think about monsoons over other parts of the globe. At this point, there's no real good explanation as to why things were so dry this past fall in that part of the country.
Okay, thank you.
Next question is from Sherry McWhorter with Traverse City Record Eagle. Your line is open.
Hi there. Thank you so much. I'm afraid that the question I was going to ask was actually asked by Dan Ventura. I put my hand up before he asked his question. So you already answered mine, and you could probably move on to the next.
All right. Thank you, Sherry. Next question comes from Chuck Collins with WEEK-TV. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. This is a question from Mike. I am in central Illinois, halfway between Chicago and St. Louis. Of course, Illinois is 400 miles long. We seem to be on the fringe of everything going on here. Can you give me an idea about Chicago, St. Louis, Peoria, Illinois, Springfield, Illinois, simply because we have a lot of real estate we're dealing with, and we're kind of on the border of the equal chances on pretty much everything, maybe a little bit above normal in precip. Can you give me an idea, especially about Chicago?
Well, like you mentioned, you know, we do tilt in the Chicago area. You know, we do tilt towards above on precipitation. Temperature is kind of a toss-up. You know, we've seen, in particular with La Nina, we've seen historically some winters have been quite cold. We've seen some that have been quite mild. Again, this is October. The character of the winter is certainly yet to be decided as to how the jet stream will set itself up. You know, if we could say more about the forecast, then we certainly would. I mean, the fact that we have equal chances for temperatures in that area means that, you know, there's either just not a real strong climate signal at this point. We'll see as we get a little closer to the winter and then into the beginning of the winter as to whether we're able to say more on shorter timescales.
Okay, thank you.
Next question is from Craig Flint with WJEP-TV. You may proceed.
All righty, guys. Hey there. Can you hear me okay clearly?
Yes, can hear you fine.
Okay, great. I'll be brief. A couple of questions ago, I think these were also answered. But being in Erie, we deal with a lot of lake effect snow, and I know that's a real finicky thing to try and pin down. But I guess my question, and I can completely respect what you guys do as a meteorologist. It's very challenging. Do you guys take a look at all the Siberian snowpack? Does that ever come up with you guys when you're making your seasonal outlooks?
Sure. This is Mike. We're certainly well aware of the studies linking that to, you know, in particular the Arctic Oscillation or the North Atlantic Oscillation, whichever you prefer. The reality is, well, first off, if that was a strong factor in our forecast, we wouldn't be able to issue these outlooks in October, right? Because in theory, the key season is during the whole entire month of October.
Right. Right.
And the reality is that the theories are that this expanse of snow cover in Siberia leads to colder winters in the east here and in the Midwest with a negative Arctic oscillation. The reality is that, and this is something we track very closely, is that the last 7 years, despite in general above average Siberian snow cover, we've seen a positive Arctic oscillation, including last year, which was one of the strongest on record. So, I don't know that it doesn't play some role, but as far as we're able to tell, it's a fairly minimal one. A lot of times we see new research, new ideas that seem to work a lot better, in the historical record. And when you try to put it into operations, not quite as successful. So reality is that we're aware of it, but it does not play a role in our outlooks.
Okay. And just one more quick question. You briefly mentioned the North Atlantic Oscillation, which personally, I think, has more of an impact on us here in the Great Lakes, and more so the Northeast than El Nino and La Nina. I'm not saying that those two oscillations don't have an impact. I mean, there's certainly some, you know, some sort of impact when it's a La Nina or El Nino in the equatorial Pacific. But when we talk about the NAO, that's not really quote-unquote forecastable this far in advance. It's more like a two-week thing. Am I wrong with that?
No. You're exactly right, and that's really one of the challenges is that the North Atlantic Oscillation can play a significant role, in the weather over the eastern half of the U.S. But really, the ability to predict it on seasonal timescale is very limited. The things with El Nino and La Nina is that they're predictable, 3-6 months in advance, and certainly
right.
Once something gets established, we know that it's going to continue. So it does. It provides something that we're able to utilize in issuing these seasonal outlooks.
Okay, great. And with the La Nina season, does the storm track typically favor what we call western runners, or does it really matter? It seems like, correct me if I'm wrong, I can't remember if my El Nino or La Nina, which storm track is more favored? Are they inland or are they on the coast more?
I think we want to probably look at it more inland, so to speak. The kind of the coastal storms and kind of the big blizzards are more frequent with El Ninos than we see with La Ninas.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, hey, thanks for your time, guys. I appreciate it.
Next question comes from Susan Wood with North Bay Business Journal. Your line is open.
Good morning, everyone. I'm going to zero in on the San Francisco Bay Area in particular because a lot of our wine country leaders in particular have been battered by firestorms this summer. So, of course, hearing of the chance of the most widespread drought since 2013, I believe I heard. I guess if I was to look at, I have a couple questions. If I was to look at a U.S. latitude map, and given that you've mentioned that two-thirds of the United States can experience ongoing drought with this La Nina, are we talking about, because the Bay Area normally falls on the cusp, are we talking about at, say, the 40-degree north latitude level and down? About where are we talking about the line might be drawn, and if you can even do that? And then I was wondering, actually, if you've studied whether, through all the La Ninas we've had in the history, whether you've seen any kind of dramatic change in that latitude line. And then I'm also wondering about whether you've studied the storm track with them, because, of course, what really has been a contributing factor to what we experienced in the summer, in particular mid-August, was just unprecedented thunderstorms and wind. So any way we can address this, Mike, David, and company?
This is Mike. There were a lot of questions thrown in there. So in terms of, and I'm going to avoid, or I'm not going to focus on the drought part. I'll just focus on the temperature and precipitation outlooks. And so both of those, we generally say, we favor above average temperatures and below average precipitation. If you're looking for a latitudinal line, both of the line is north of San Francisco in both cases, somewhere between San Francisco, for precip between San Francisco and the kind of the Oregon-California border. That's close to where the temperature is. Precipitation is a little bit south of there. So you know, has that shifted over history? You know, not that we're aware of. You know, again, the reality is these are probabilistic forecasts, and the probabilities aren't really that high, mainly because, you know, every La Nina is different. It doesn't act alone. You know, even if it acted the exact same way, and it certainly doesn't, the conditions around the rest of the globe are different every time that we see another La Nina. So I'm not aware of any specific work that says, you know, that the drier areas are expanding further north or the wetter areas are expanding to the south. You know, in terms of our models, I would say probably the one thing we do see is that maybe the colder area to the north is maybe shrinking a little bit. You know, it just seems to be easier for temperatures to be above normal than below normal. But I haven't seen that same type of a signal in precipitation at all.
Hey, this is Dave Miskus here. As far as the seasonal drought outlook goes, we had put the improvement about a third of the way, one-third northern portion of the west there, based on the equal chances and above-normal precipitation for the winter, mainly because it is the wet season, especially in the Pacific Northwest right now. So if they get near normal to above normal precipitation during their wet season, we would tend to see some improvement, at least in the drought, for that. But again, the further south you go with the odds for below normal precipitation, that's why I believe we put development by the end of January through that area, which will pretty much cover all of California.
Thank you. Any research on the storm tracks becoming more, isolated, where they're more extreme at once rather than spread out through the winter?
You know, again, not this is Mike, not anything that I've seen that's, you know, really conclusive in terms of that. I mean, you know, along the West Coast, certainly a lot of the rain that will fall will fall in atmospheric river events, so to speak. And, you know, if the jet stream, as we typically see with La Nina, has shifted further to the north, then that's why we favor a wetter than average Pacific Northwest and a drier than average California. So that's, you know, But here in mid-October, it's, you know, the character of where the jet stream will end up is not able, you know, we're not able to say with any specificity. And again, whether or not, you know, a couple of storms are up into California or down into California and the remainder of the storms are up into Oregon and Washington, you know, that's what will kind of give the character of what the winter ends up as.
Thank you.
Our next question is from Karen Usher with Cadillac News. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks. I have two questions. One, I was wondering if you could briefly address how average temperatures have evolved over time. And then my second question is, I was wondering if you could be a little bit more specific when we're talking about signals. Like what signals are we talking about? Unless I'm mishearing that word. Thank you.
So this is Mike. I'm not sure. Maybe I've used the word signal. Maybe I haven't. I'm not sure in what it was in reference to, but I think we're probably talking about those types of climate factors that will shape the winter weather. And for this particular winter, we were really leaning heavily on La Nina. You know, it's one that's still developing. We're not sure how strong it will become, but it does continue to build, at least over the last month or so. That's what we're seeing. The first part of that question, could you repeat?
How average temperatures have evolved over time?
Sure, and that is something that we pay attention to quite closely, because when we're saying that we expect above or below average conditions, we're literally, you have to define what average is. In terms of temperature, when we update that period, and we do that every 10 years, so that will be coming up shortly, we see that those average temperatures in a general sense increase. You know, it's not a huge increase on the 30-year period that we look at, but as we move forward with that, you know, there's little doubt that, that average temperatures are have gone up in a very general sense, you know, across the whole country.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Kimberly Cartier with EOS. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my question. My question is about ocean temperatures. Can you talk more about what the forecasts show for ocean temperatures on in the Pacific and Atlantic, if you can, and the Gulf, and whether it's within the normal range for a typical La Nina year?
So this is Mike. We don't, you know, we do have computer simulations. The only areas of the ocean that we actually are making forecasts for are the equatorial Pacific, which is where La Nina or El Nino are centered. The current forecasts for the area in the East Central Pacific are for them to cool a little further relative to normal over the next couple of months. You know, and again, that will again go into how strong this La Nina ends up becoming. As far as temperatures, you know, in the Gulf or in the Atlantic, you know, I don't look at that. It's not something that's part of our forecast process. There's a lot that goes into, in particular in the Gulf. You know, I was noticing with some of the tropical cyclone activity we've seen that sometimes it just takes a couple of significant cold fronts, you know, at various times to cool down those waters, at least temporarily. So I would think that even our forecast models trying to predict that on the seasonal timescale would be quite challenging.
Great, thank you.
Next question comes from Seth Bornstein with Associated Press. Your line is open.
Thanks again. Mike, just to put for the big picture, you know, not, you know, just overall, make, is it, from listening to you, it sounds like this is you're not expecting one of these winters that we'll remember, you know, years later, sort of no big, not big punches like a few years ago. Is that fair to say? Or, I mean, is this not exactly mild, but sort of not much of a wallop here?
You know, if you're asking about do we see this winter shaping up with extremes, you know, it's really beyond our ability to make a forecast like that. I mean, you know, you could go back to any of the kind of noteworthy type winters, and the one that for me always comes to mind is 2009, 2010. You know, we certainly didn't see that before it came. So, you know, I would say that unless we're dealing with, you know, the real strong El Niños like we, you know, we see every 15 or 20 years, you know, we probably don't ever really anticipate any type of a memorable winter in advance.
Okay. There are no, is it fair to say there are no indications, or is it more that you just can't see it? You don't have that.
Well, kind of. Yeah, I mean, the reality is both. I mean, there really aren't any indicators at this point, but I'm not sure what those indicators would be, to be honest.
Hey, Seth, this is Dave here. Now, if you're in the Southwest and this drought does intensify and we don't get any relief, that's going to be a big deal to those people down there as far as agriculture and water. So it depends, I guess, how you look on it as a big winter punch here, because down there this is will be a big deal for them.
Right, and I'm wondering if that's the overall story here, is that the winter punch may not be the big snowfalls, but the worsening drought.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
I mean, that's fair to say, and again, you know, while we don't issue seasonal snow outlooks, certainly La Nina is usually not associated with the big East Coast snowstorms. I mean, that's far more common with the El Nino.
And the Southwest was really looking for a good winter snowpack there to help them with this drought, but right now the forecast is not looking good for that.
Okay, great. All right, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
And our next question comes from Nancy Gardner with Omaha World Herald. Your line is open.
This is kind of a follow-up to Seth's question, really. When will you know more? Is there a time in the fall, early winter, where La Nina typically is locked in and you've got a sense of things? Or is it just kind of week by week? Thank you.
Well, we're you know, just as far as La Nina goes, we're very confident. I think the forecast we issued last week was somewhere around 85% that this will certainly persist through the winter. If you're asking whether we'll know, you know, the character of the winter, will we see, you know, more cold or more snow across the north definitively? You know, maybe as patterns start to set up as we get into the early part of the winter, you know, but you know, maybe not. It just really, again, depends. I hate to keep repeating, but again, it depends on the character of the winter. And certainly at this point, there's really not much more that we can say about it. I mean, in a general sense, you know, the outlook, again, favors below average precipitation, above average temperatures across the south, and you know, the flip of that, you know, and again, that would be the typical northward shift of the jet stream that we see with La Nina.
Okay, thanks a lot.
And speakers, at this time, we do not have any additional questions. Thank you.
All right, that is going to conclude our teleconference for today. Thanks to all of our media partners for dialing in and for their great questions. I want to thank our speakers, Mike Halpert, Deputy Director of NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, and David Miskus, meteorologist and drought expert at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, as well as Ira Sanchez Lugo, climatologist from NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, for their expertise today. The Winter Outlook news release and maps are available on NOAA.gov. If you have any follow-up questions, feel free, again, to send me an email or to call. My email address is at the top of today's media advisory, lauren.gacius@noaa.gov. That's lauren.gacius, as in Sam, at noaa.gov. My cell phone as well is 202-740-8314. That concludes our briefing on the 2020 U.S. Winter Outlook. I thank you all for joining us today.
That concludes today's conference. Thank you all for participating. Have an amazing day.